On the agenda today, we have issue 80, remove the initial context from the API spec. So we might want to wrap that discussion up. We have use of native types in from and to RDF, the API calls. The context processing algorithm is a bit incomplete in that it doesn't tell you how to resolve dependencies. We have issue 153, which is talking about the error handler behavior. And then a bug, seemingly, in the Compact IRI API call. Is there anything else that we should discuss today? Anything else that needs to be put on the agenda?
I'm just going to note that next week is when I'm speaking on JSON-LD and Mongo at the NoSQL conference. And I'll put slides up today or tomorrow on SlideShare, and anyone has any comments or suggestions, it'll be time for me to address that before the actual talk.
Great. And I guess, what approach are you taking with this talk? Because I know you said the last talk, some of the people in the audience were a bit, they thought it was too heavyweight because the API was kind of shown. Are you taking a different angle in this talk, or are you talking mostly about just databases and JSON-LD, or?
No, I'm. My take is to really stay away from the algorithms for the most part. I'm introducing some of the concepts, showing basically the expanded form and the compacted form, and then I discuss a little bit on how, you know, basically how you get to the compacted form and what the benefits are of either keeping things in the expanded form or the compacted form. And then with regards to integration with JSON-LD, my recommendations on basically object granularity and using the expanded form of subject references to make it easy to navigate through structures that are returned and do the graphify, link, whatever, whatever mechanism that I think is becoming fairly common for many of us. There's actually two mechanisms I use. One is I'll go through and I will create a graph, but it's quite useful when you're dealing with objects in, say, a backbone model system, mm-hmm. where you don't really want to, you don't want the representation that you keep in memory to differ from that you get back from the service to abstract it at another layer. So at the point you retrieve attributes, then apply the mapping so that you get references to other models. And that's worked very well for me. So it's basically some practical experience over a couple of approaches I've taken in my current work. By the way, and I'm not quite able to generally provide links to it right now, but what I have built is a basically a serialization of schema.org as well as some customized schemas I'm using for Wikia into a JSON-LD serialization, which then feeds a backbone application that, one, gives full sort of pretty cool documentation for all of those API points. And I use constraints quite a lot in order to get a little bit more structure to the data I want. And then there is a sort of an object editor, which is based upon the object model is defined by the schema, which allows it to create, edit, validate, etc., all of those object instances, which are then stored back in a MongoDB collection. So it's really quite useful and general purpose for pretty much any application that is based upon really any schema, because it's very little of it is based upon schema.org as well.
Cool, very cool. So are you going to be able to put the code out in the public at some point?
I believe so. I had a discussion about it yesterday, and it's sort of everything else Wikia does is open source. So there's no reason why this would not be either. It just is not quite ready. But okay. I believe it will be in the coming months.
Okay. Cool.
And by the way, Nicholas, I took your lead, and I ended up doing the back end all in CoffeeScript.
Right. Cool.
Which is sort of fun, but not quite enough far enough away from JavaScript for me. It, you still have to fall back to many of its traps.
Yeah, I tinker with CoffeeScript a lot, but I switch back and forth between that and JavaScript depending on the audience and the target for the code in general. It's a bit nicer to work in them.
But I think this type of application is really shows the advantages of something like JSON-LD for dealing with linked data models. And that's why I sort of prefer the term, you know, it's an API term of link, because what it's really doing is linking the data internally. And of course, being able to resolve external references, one of the things that you can do with a JSON-LD object is to, when you're storing it in Mongo, extract all of the subject references into another field, which then allows you to query them. So I can, when I'm editing a specific object, I can do one query to get back all of the objects that have any relationship going out or back into the one that I'm editing. So that's what allows me to pull in the various link relationships as the session progresses. So link is a pretty useful term in general for what I'm doing.
Yeah, okay. I used connect in my RDFA experiment, the same connotation.
Yeah.
To put them together.
Okay. Well, that's good. Certainly link and connect are better than objectify. And potentially,
or graphify.
Yeah.
Potentially better than graphify.
Yeah. In my RDFA tinkering, I always have a simple ID which I sort of use to drive sidetracks forward. So I never get to the actual execution of the ID. What I'm really about to do is a schema vocabulary presentation and then subsequently some kind of editor thing. I've done that years ago, but I want to do it all with the JSON-LD approach, but what I do instead is to work with the RDFA API, which I saw you, Manu, retweeted. So did you have a chance to take a look at what
I saw the page. I was not able to go and dig down into the API, but the page was really cool because it really showed you what the structure kind of the objects were while allowing you to kind of continue reading the page. It was just a good, I thought, just at the most superficial level, I thought it was a very great visualization of how the data kind of fits onto the page. I think it would help people kind of understand.
Can you paste a link in?
Yeah, sure. It's nothing really to do with JSON-LD at this moment, though. I'm getting back to that because the presentation in that page is the RDFA CSS. The most interesting part of the page is if you look at the console output and the actual code, which I use in the head of the document, because I've implemented get elements by property, by subject, and by type unorthodoxly, because what I do is that I have a data attribute which contains the expanded forms of property, resource, and such, and then I use query selector to get native speed in selecting all the relevant elements without ever having to parse the actual RDFA into triples. And then I'm going to continue with that using my... I did a rewrite during the vacation of the RDFA to JSON-LD extraction, which I mentioned last Thursday or something like that, I think, to you, Manu, that I do RDFA2 expanded JSON-LD directly instead because of the various potential mismatches and teaching problems with using queries as the output from RDFA in the general case. But I will write all of that in the wiki sooner or later. The real goal with this experiment is to produce put more of the parser logic into that DOM API to eventually be able to produce JSON-LD from the DOM API in a quite natural way. It seems to be just some 20 to 40 lines of JavaScript once the DOM API is done, and that part of the API won't actually have to parse everything. I will write it down to make it more sensible, but I'm trying to find a balance between the logic needed to extract the context in terms of the DOM and what the current element represents, i.e. it represents a property and it has a link or a value, and then it has an environment. So it has a subject, which comes from a subject element, which is apparent. And all of these things can be quite simply connected without having to parse the entirety of the, without extracting any triples from them. And once I have this logic in place, I can use that abstraction upon the DOM tree to easily produce triples if I need to. But the goal of the DOM API is to be able to navigate through the DOM using RDF concepts.
Yeah, that's certainly great. I think one of the big things that we're missing right now is that ability to take the data on the page and convert it to some kind of JSON like object, right? I mean, that's I think one of the key features that Microdata currently has, this idea that you have an API and you can just do get items and it'll give you, you know, this fairly useful group of objects that you can use. So
the interesting part is actually done. I mean, I've done that twice already. extracting JSON-LD. So that part works very well. I passed 50% of the tests, and I didn't even break sweat doing that, so I can fix the relevant parts for compatibility for later on. The Microdata API actually gives you back elements, and that's what struck me. That's why I worked on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Microdata API gives you the elements carrying the properties, and then if you do to JSON, you get the actual JSON representation, which is their superficial representation of the tree. It dawned on me then that's the way forward for the DOM API, to extend it to be able to make, to navigate, saying, give me the parent element carrying the subject of this property, because that's what you want the DOM API for. You want to be able to highlight elements and move them and things like that.
Okay, cool. Okay, so yeah, I mean that's great. Can't wait to see both your and Nicholas and Greg's stuff come out, so that we can look at it and play around with it, hopefully, if the code's available. Okay. Anything else on the agenda before we start?
I think I have had a question about something we brought up earlier. I didn't find an issue for it. We said that some time ago that it might make sense to make vocab and language intransitive, meaning that if you inherit a context from another context, you don't necessarily inherit the language from that external context.
Yeah.
The reason being that if you have some context which sets the language, you don't really see that when you edit the data. So I think that only the closest context should affect the current language. It might be a good idea.
I thought the counter argument to that was that if people are creating context, they should not put language in there, meaning that the language should travel with your data. But there are exceptions to that rule in that, you know, someone might say title underscore DE, and they always want to set the title when somebody uses, or so they always want to set the language German whenever somebody uses title underscore DE. And if we did what you're saying, that wouldn't work anymore. So I think they're trade-offs, right? I mean,
but they could do, I mean, only when you have language in the top level of the context, not if you have language within a term definition. That should reasonably, or that must be applied.
In the path that takes us down is added complexity to understanding how language works, because sometimes it applies, sometimes it doesn't.
I agree.
If
someone produces a nasty context for inheriting, which defines vocab and language, you can always set them to null to cancel them out. So it's not a big word. I just wanted to mention it again because we had put it forward before. Also, have we reintroduced, I haven't read the spec lately, is there text for vocab back in place yet?
I think it is in there, yes.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't put it in there. Someone else must have.
I think perhaps Marcus did, because I was I wanted to be sure when I did my slides, and so I didn't put it in unless it was in the spec, and I believe I did.
Okay.
I reintroduced it, basically. Like, we had it in there already before, so I more or less just reused that text that we had before and updated the algorithms.
Yeah, I remember what I had to do is after the fact go in and update the formalized syntax.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
But which, by the way, I've never gotten any feedback on, and I don't think that didn't make it into the FPWD.
It didn't. Unfortunately I'm backlogged with a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm hoping to find some time soon to be able to update the spec and look through that stuff, Greg, and give you some feedback on it.
Yeah, I just wanted to see. I think it pretty adequately satisfies what Andy wanted, and it'd just be good to get some feedback if it does or not.
Okay. You could ask. Have you asked Andy yet?
I believe I think I resolved the issue, or at least I commented the issue on him, so he knows that it's been completed, but I haven't specifically reached out for feedback now.
Okay.
But, you know, he also might be waiting for a draft update. I presume the getting a next WD out in the RDF working group is probably takes a bigger decision than just pushing a button.
Yeah, we have to get the group to agree to publish a working draft. It's not as difficult as the FPWD. It's easier than the FPWD, but
there's probably more stuff that has to go in there first, though.
Yes and no, in that you can push a working draft at any point you want, but let's go ahead and make a solid pass through it. We're supposed to be pushing working drafts every 3 months to show activity. And really, we push a working draft, one working draft from the working group every 3 months, which means that one of those could be Turtle, and then 6 months, 3 months later, it could be Jason LD, and then 3 months later, it could be Turtle again. So that's the only requirement we have. So we're fine as far as requirements are concerned, but you're right. I think we do need to clean up a lot of this stuff that we've resolved, put it in the spec, and push another version out there. Okay.
I took some time this weekend to catch up on my Python implementation of the JSON-LD extractor for the RDF lib here as well. It's not complete, but it passes a lot of tests and supports
great.
The general syntax.
Awesome.
I'll probably add vocab pretty soon as well, because I have some questions about details there, which I'll reasonably figure out doing that.
Cool. No, this is great. Yeah, I think we're pretty solid on implementations, which is really good. I don't think we're going to have a very long CR period, as long as, you know, we're all on the same page as far as what the implementation should do. Okay, let's go ahead and jump to our first item on the agenda, just to make sure that we don't get too far into the call without addressing issues. We shouldn't spend too much time on issue 80, which is basically the decision to remove the initial context from the API spec. It sounded last week, that we were basically split, with Greg feeling that we really should put something in there now because it would be dangerous to, because if we don't put it in there now, it's going to be really hard to update it later on. I agreed with Greg, but probably a little less, in that I would probably be okay with it being left out, but still don't think that would be a very good idea. And then from what I remember, Nicholas and Marcus, you guys didn't feel like we needed to put that in there at this point. Is that a accurate portrayal of the discussion?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I think so. Although I wavered a bit when I worked with stuff the past week, thinking that it might be nice to have like XSD and RDF and some more predefined, you know, for convenience.
Mm-hmm.
But schema, then again, I had, although schema, not schema, the query for schema is only half as many bytes as the URI for the schema base. So it's fairly easy to...
I end up setting vocab to schema for most of what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the question is, I don't think we should do that. I mean,
right.
I'm not sure that I want to, per default, endorse their world domination. Although I sort of support it in to some degree for convenience, but I'm really torn on these topics.
Yeah, I'm not as torn. I definitely don't like the worldview or the approach that they're taking. But I mean, you know, people are using it because they want to show up highly in search listings, and it's nice because it does have quite a number of terms. It's dangerous to give a large company that amount of power. Anyway, so I guess the strongest argument, I guess, would be if we think that we should put XSD and RDF in there, the natural way to do it would be an initial context. So perhaps discussing that would help us find what we should do with this topic. Part of me thinks that, I'm kind of split on this. I think it would be nice to have XSD and RDF predefined because they're used you use them fairly often, depending on certain types of linked data, use them pretty heavily. But then all of a sudden there are these predefined terms, and we've never had that before. And maybe it would be more confusing to authors because there are predefined terms now, and they have to understand what those are. Any thoughts on whether or not it'd be helpful to have predefined terms?
I agree with that sentiment very much, actually, because I think that, well, I've had problems with the default or the FA context in terms of teachability and the leveling the ground by not having something implicit is a very clean initial approach. If we have, just so I don't forget it, if we decide to have an initial context, it should be able to completely cancel it by setting context to null within a context.
Mm-hmm. I agree. My feeling, though, is that I'm not so sure about RDF, since in reality, I rarely use RDF, the RDF namespace in JSON-LD. However, one of the advantages of JSON-LD over other JSON serialization, specifically the microdata serialization, support for data types. If you're going to do any support of data types, you pretty much have to use XSD. So it's in our examples, I'll use XSD. They include a definition of XSD. It's easy to forget to add in the XSD definition. And as much as I've used it, I continually have to go back and look up the URI. It's unfortunate a lot of those early namespaces were not very convenient. RDF is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think if we were to...
That
well, good for you. Maybe you're probably younger than I am. my brain cells perhaps aren't quite as flexible in that regard. However, I would think it a having XSD as a predefined term in the initial context would be very useful and avoid a lot of easy mistakes. I don't really, nothing else quite rises to the level of convenience for me as XSD.
Yeah, I have the same issue. I can't remember XSD, and there have been numerous times over the past 8 months where I've been authoring JSON-LD and have completely forgotten to put it in there and have spent an hour trying to figure out why, you know, certain terms aren't expanding to what they should be. Mostly because we do a whole bunch of normalization and digital signatures, and I have to go through a couple of layers before I get to the point where I see that the XSD stuff isn't, you know, defined. So I agree with Greg. Go ahead.
You don't really use XSD that often anyway. It's just for dates, basically, because floats, integers, you have the native data types in JSON-LD.
Well, dates.
Date and date time.
Pretty common.
Yeah. It should be noted that.
I also use it. I use it for the OWL serialization stuff. Most of the cardinality are unsigned integers, and it's important for me to be able to declare the terms, the OWL terms, as taking a range of unsigned integer in order to because you can't do it natively, you have to declare something. Of course, that's certainly not a typical usage pattern, but that's something that I have to rely on quite often.
Yeah, that's true. Two points. One is actually not so much of a point, more than another thing about Schema.org. I'm at odds with that. They have defined their own data types, which are basically string derived, but they don't even extend XSD.
Yes,
so
in the OWL serial, in the OWL definition they have, which admittedly isn't very up to date, they end up being object properties, which makes it very really not useful. They should be data type properties. Probably the RDFS.org version is better in that regard, although I don't think it actually contains as much ranging information.
We had some discussion on that on Google Plus this weekend, me and Saganiak mostly, I think, about the well the usefulness of the RDFA representation and going forward.
I'm referring to the original RDF XML owl. I haven't looked closely at the RDFA version, and probably should start to migrate towards that, because I know there's been some discussion about round tripping. Interesting to note that it's not something you can do really with microdata. Someplace where you really need RDFA. I do all my modeling in Protégé, and I've using their OWL serialization really gave me a head start on being able to define the data models that I needed to use. So there's a lot of value for me in having that kind of a ontology description.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You should take a look at the RDFA representation, because for one, they don't use RDFS range and domain. They use schema.org range and domain.
Yeah, I think there's been some discussion about sort of defining their own ontology language within schema, and that there might be some advantages to doing that. For instance, the union concept in OWL is very convoluted. I think
that's
discussion
exactly
on using a property for that. Yeah.
Yeah, the problems is that that part is I sympathize with that, but the problem is that if you use schema.org as a schema language as well, and you want to dereference that to do inference, you get schema.org world view of everything, including medical and ecology and lake and
so I'm counting on Richard and Michael Hausenblas to continue their great work on representing that using OWL, because that's the way that tools like mine would like to work, is allow them to express it using a higher level ontology, but as long as there are tools that can produce something that is more universally parsable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, so we're kind of deviating a bit from the initial context discussion.
Yeah.
XSD. Not to say that it's not interesting, but we should hopefully put this issue to bed. The alternative, if you know, when things are kind of split like this, the alternative is to come up with another proposal that's more agreeable to everyone. I'm struggling a bit to figure out what that proposal is, because this really is put initial context in there or don't. And I think all of us agreed that putting it as a may is even more dangerous, because that is an interoperability nightmare. So sorry to hear your sleep deprived, Nicholas, the same way. Nicholas, Marcus, any changes in your thoughts on this? Or Greg, any changes in your thoughts?
No, I mean, of course it's convenient if you end up using exactly the terms or the vocabularies that are defined in the initial context, but first of all, I don't think that prefixes are one of the good features of JSON-LD, or one that is going to be used often.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if there are prefixes in there which you don't use, they don't have any value for you. They might even clash with some other things that you have in there, and that shouldn't even be expanded to a full IRI.
That's a really interesting problem, actually, which I struck me before. If we add that anything used as a prefix cannot be used as an implicit term with the default vocab unless you reset it, they will collide.
Yes.
I have thought about suggesting, for other reasons than that actually, that I think we've discussed it before, though we maybe voted it down, the possibility of you defining a term with a trailing colon to mean only use this as a prefix, never as a term. Has that come up?
I don't think so.
That's
usually
idea.
The argument was that we don't want to have microsynthesis.
Right.
Yeah. I can. But that's a special case because I felt that I had some issue. I have to look it up because there was some collision there, which I realized would be preventable if I didn't use the term. Now, that's right. I defined the thing to use as a prefix locally to make term declarations simpler and more compact. I wanted to use lots of different vocabularies and declare type coercions for several terms there. And the problem was that I did not want that prefix to be used later on in general, and it ended up somewhere where I wanted to refer to the vocabulary or something like that. So I think that's what prompted the idea.
Greg, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for my part, I do end up using prefixes a lot. Firstly, within a context definition, it's much compacter to use prefixes to define other terms than it is to spell each term's IRI out explicitly.
Yeah.
And then within the data, I really rely on terms only for those things that I explicitly use within my code. And when I am doing things that try to work with more generic data, the fact that they're terms or queries really doesn't really impact me at all. And it's particularly when working with multiple vocabularies, it's really more convenient to keep things in a query syntax. So in my use anyway, I do find a lot of use for queries. And I think as we discussed some time ago, for generic representation of RDF translated, say, from Turtle, it's a more natural way to represent the data using queries, as long as you have access to the prefix definitions from the original serialization, which is what my processor does.
But in that case, there isn't the danger that you forget the declaration because it comes directly from Turtle.
Well, I was responding to your point that prefixes, I think, weren't very useful in general for you, queries rather. I find that they are. With regards to the initial context, as I said, I think the only one that I think really needs to be in there is XSD. Other than that, I can see some advantage of defining some other common prefixes, but XSD is the only one that I really feel more strongly about.
Okay, so that actually helps me make my mind up one way or the other. So if the idea here is that people forget to declare XSD, and as Marcus or Nicholas pointed out, the only time you tend to use XSD is when you're declaring contexts. And if the general usage pattern is that regular developers, quote unquote regular developers, aren't going to be creating contexts that often, meaning that if they do forget XSD, they are not going to do it on a regular basis, meaning that they're probably going to work on their context once or twice, they're going to forget XSD once, and they're going to fix it, and then after that, they're probably not going to have too much of an issue. All right. So I think at this point, I'm leaning more towards let's not put it in there, mainly because I think it makes it easier to kind of understand JSON-LD because everything's kind of there in front of you. There's no magic initial context that's hanging out there that you have to know about. If people forget XSD, it's going to be more than likely when they're editing a context. So that is going to be an operation that's performed far less than just editing regular JSON documents. And so, yeah, I think at this point, and I guess I'm not as concerned about being able to put this feature in there if things go off the rails, because I think that we have enough implementers here to implement it and then kind of force the other implementations to put initial context in there before a spec update is made, if that makes sense. So in the very, very worst case, we find out that for whatever reason there's this prefix that's not being declared, and for whatever reason the data is still being used by someone like Facebook or Google, we could at that point force the implementations to support an initial context and spec out how that happens, and then wait for, you know, the W3C process to catch up. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, first off, I definitely agree. That's a good argument. And then just to mention, as far as I know, Turtle has never had, and during the standardization now, I don't recall seeing it ever having a default prefix for instance, XST.
No, the one place where I continually miss it is Sparkle, where I am.
Yeah.
If I'm doing an ad hoc query, having to remember to put the prefixes in is very inconvenient. And I've seen a number of tools that sort of allow you to automatically populate it with common prefixes, just for that reason, if you want to be able to do ad hoc queries. At this point, I don't feel strongly enough to object to not having it, and I can see everyone's point. I guess my feeling is that I do think it does more good than harm, but I think I'll just vote a minus zero on a resolution.
Okay. Okay, so let's get a proposal down here. Do not support the an initial context in JSON LD 1.0. All right. All right, that's resolved. That's good. And I guess, you know, Greg, I do still have some of your concerns, but I think that, you know, at least the implementers right now are a fairly tightly knit group, meaning that I think all of us could get on a phone call and decide to put in initial context in a couple of minutes and figure out, you know, how to spec it out and put it out there pretty quickly. So I think that if there is something catastrophic that happens in the future, we can get together and fix it, hopefully. Okay, anything else on this issue before we go on? Okay, the next issue up is issue 150, use of native types from and to RDF. Marcus, you raised this issue. Would you mind giving us an overview?
Well, basically, before we decided to have a FLAC, which is use native types in the from and to RDF, in the from RDF algorithm, and that was kind of like, coarse FLAC, which automatically assumed that we are using XST Boolean, XST integer, and XST double to convert them to native JSON types. And then Dave Longley proposed to split that flag into four different flags, which specify the data type for each of the native types. So basically one flag for integers, which maps per default to XST integer, one for double, which maps to XST double, and one for Boolean, which maps to Boolean. And well, there's even another one for type, let's just see now. So the question is basically if we want to do that or not.
Uh, I'm not really. Yeah, I can sort of, as I recall, it has been several months since all this came up, and the reasons had to do with expanding and compacting native types or not, which I believe we do not do into these XSD representations. But adding flags to the RDF serialization is, I just think it makes it a little bit crufty and unwieldy. I would rather come up with a set of practices that perhaps are just constrained to the RDF serialization and don't relate to expand and compact, say, and just fix these things so that if you see an integer, if you're transforming an integer from RDF to RDF, then it's a XSD integer, or which could be represented natively in Turtle. And if you're coming back in, you do the same thing. Because I think that really is the way that people are going to use the information.
Well, I think the question is in the other direction. It's in from RDF. So if you are using, if you have a lot of data with, I don't know, unsigned integers, and you want to convert that into integers, I think that's what Dave Longley wanted to achieve.
Yeah, but see, it would be wrong in my mind to use native integers to express unsigned integers. I don't do that. I use strings. I don't find the value in having it expressed as a native integer type when it actually is not a native integer.
No, that's making the flag. The flags would be doing transformation. So you, I agree with that. You should use a context if you want to turn those into native integers.
So I guess the main concern I have with this is that we are going to prevent some kind of use case. So the argument, Greg, I think your argument that says that, well, it's going to make the to RDF or from RDF algorithm crufty or, you know, more complicated, I don't think that matters to anyone that's actually using the library. Like, they don't care how much code is sitting behind this stuff. And as long as the defaults are good for 90% of the people, most people won't need to see this at all. But I guess the concern was, well, what happens if you actually do don't want the default behavior? Let's say that all of the integers that you get in, you actually want them to come through as strings in the JSON for whatever reason. And if we said, well, this is the one way to do the translation, then we can't necessarily, people can't do that in that they would have to write another processing step. So the concern here is to address, help the people that would like to transform their data in some particular way that doesn't fit into the standard way that you could convert, let's say, a Turtle document to JSON-LD.
I guess my concern is more, certainly if everything I did was using the JSON-LD API, then being able to trigger things through the API calls would not be so bad. But more typically in mine, I'm doing serialization or deserialization as part of an RDF toolset where there are sort of some standard interfaces that make use of the API internally, but that is not the typical interface which is exposed to a user. And moreover, in the context of, say, a distiller, I have, you know, an RDF distiller, and it understands input and output from various different languages, and so far it hasn't needed any significant special attributes to add for any given serialization. So it would not really be able to express this type of thing, say, within my online distiller without doing some custom JSON-LD thing, which I'd be disinclined to do. In general, I believe that my serializers in for like Turtle say, do not make use of the native representation for these things by default, and they do not typically. There maybe are some tools that allow people to do it, but I use string representations for things generally.
I think the question is if we want to kind of decouple JSON-LD from XSD, because for example in schema.org they have their own data types and we are kind of restricted to use the XSD data types. And well, that's the argument in separating it. On the other hand, Greg's argument of course stands that it makes it more complex.
Yeah, so how would someone take I guess the major downside of this, Greg, is that it complicates the algorithm, right? There isn't any other horribly negative thing that comes out of this. There are two sides of this. One is that it horribly complicates the algorithm. Let's just say it horribly complicates the algorithm. And then the other way to approach this is to say that we could always add these features in the future if we get a lot of people complaining about it. Because we can say, oh, well, by default, the defaults were always to go to XSD. We're just going to, in JSON-LD 2.0 or 1.1, we're just going to expose what those defaults are and allow people to change it.
I think if we look at two different... Oh, I'm sorry. Don't want to jump to Kira.
No, go ahead, Greg. I think that...
Well, I think we could look at this from two different sides. If we're going from JSON-LD to RDF, the notion of using the native doing a direct XSD transformation of the data types is fairly intuitive, I think, is pretty much what anyone working in RDF would expect would happen. Now, going from RDF to JSON-LD, that's a different issue. And I guess my thought would be, is we do not make use of native data types when transforming from RDF into JSON-LD.
It seems like we could very easily, though, right? I mean, it seems
we could.
And it seems like that's how, you know, most JSON developers would want to work with the data. I mean, there is a clear transformation that we've kind of outlined. So I guess the question is, you know, why don't we just do that? Because that seems to be what most JSON developers would want anyway. I mean, I don't want to have to do a post-processing step over my data to convert something that I know is a number that was specified as a number to an actual number in JSON.
Yeah, that's a reasonable argument, and I also agree with the sentiments that you said there. I just the way that I tend to do it in, say, Turtle, is that I don't make use of it, but that's just my specific implementation.
Well, I'm wondering if the go ahead.
No, I said my say.
I'm wondering if the reason you do that is because Turtle doesn't have a very a set in memory representation. Like it's not, you know, Turtle, when you convert it to something or when you convert RDF XML, you're not actually converting it into kind of the standard data model that almost everybody uses, right? It's not just JavaScript object, it's something completely different. And I think that the case that we're dealing with here is slightly different in that, you know, a JavaScript object, you know, people expect their numbers to be numbers and they expect the floats to be floats and strings to be strings and booleans to be booleans. So if we deviate from creating an object that people just understand as a first-class citizen in the language, then I think that is going to be more of a shock to them than anything else.
Yeah, no, I see your point. My point was that I think we can separate these issues somewhat with regards to what default behavior is from going to RDF and from RDF.
Okay. Nicholas, did you have something that you wanted to add in here? You were on the queue.
Yeah, no, I would only think out loud. I see cases for both sides of the argument. I think that I mainly agree with Greg because I think that there is a standard way to say what types are in RDF, but I'm not too married to the concept.
Another option is to allow the implementer to decide what the ending JSON object is, but that's a compatibility nightmare. It's an interoperability nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, but I think you're not going to prevent authors from doing things that they perceive as providing value for their users. So I could certainly imagine that I might provide some interfaces to allow some greater fidelity, but it probably would not be a matter of saying to treat integers, native integers, as being unsigned integers. It possibly would mean treat things with decimals as a decimal rather than as a double. That's something I could imagine doing. More likely, it would be a general flag saying something like, you know, use native data type representations, rather, you know, so not necessarily getting into a mapping. And if it was a simple matter of, I think perhaps language such as, you know, implementations may provide a mechanism to allow these rules to be overridden or to allow the native use or the non-native use of representations when going from RDF to JSON-LD, that would be adequate for most people's purposes.
Hmm. Okay, so just to clarify, we are going to have a use native types flag, right? We're not talking about getting rid of that. Is that right?
Do we have one now? I don't remember.
I think we do. I think we decided. I think that was part of the decision,
introduce use native
right?
data types.
Yeah. Yeah, we decided that a couple of months ago.
But I think this notion of type mapping was an alternative to that, or a way to break down a flag into some more specific information.
Yeah.
And I guess that's probably what I'm reacting to, is that I think that's a little too heavy-handed.
Okay, so yeah. And then the argument is that we could always put this in later. These could always be options that could go in later, and if you just have used native data types, we have something set in the spec that says this is how you convert to native data types, and then if somebody wants to override it in JSON-LD 1.1 or 2.0, we can introduce these flags at that point. And that's not a backwards compatibility issue or anything of that nature.
Right.
Okay. Are there any disagreements on that being the path that we want to take? So we'll basically say we keep using native data types. We are not going to support overriding what each native data type is. And then we'll also note that in the future we could add this feature if it's required or if it's asked for by the public, without introducing any backwards compatibility issues. Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah, that sounds good. And also, do we have the flag that when I go from RDF, I can decide whether I want type to be represented as just a link or as at type?
I thought that was different.
That might have been confused by the mention of type in the issue. But I believe we have
such a flag.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm just to ensure that that's intact by anything changed here.
Yeah. Type. I don't know which one of our 128 closed issues it is.
Let me see if I can
allow term the, definitions
in the spec
91.
Oh, in the spec, at least in the spec from RDF, it says that the set of options include not type, which if set to true causes the resulting document to use RDF type as a property instead of at type. And that's just what I was looking. Great. Then I'm happy.
Okay. All right. So the proposal is use native data types. Do not support setting each. Do not support overriding each native data type. Let's see. Support use native data types. Do not support overriding each native data type. Okay, so is that it? Support use native data types from RDF. Do not support overriding each native data type with a different value. Does this look? Hold on. Continue to support specifying. Options for. Okay, so how does that look?
Looking at my implementation, I see that I also implemented an option to not use at type for RDF type. And I think that was probably because of some discussion that Nicholas started some time ago about how that often got in the way.
Yeah, I think that's just what Nicholas mentioned right now. Right, Nicholas? You wanted to make sure that you had the option of using RDF colon type instead of at type for everything. Okay, that's resolved. Note, if this feature needs to be added in the future, it can be done without creating any backwards compatibility issues. Okay, great. Next up is issue 151. This is the context processing algorithm, how it resolves dependencies. So the main concern here is that, let's see, the main concern here is that if you use something like, I'm going to use a security vocabulary as an example, or actually just use schema. So if you define schema somewhere up at the top of the document, so let's say you do this, issue is this. Fine, like so. A schema, HTTP schema.org. So the context. So if you do something like that, and then later you do this name schema colon name. So we don't have a very clear algorithm on how you go and find what schema is. So we can do it multiple ways, and there's some corner cases where you may resolve schema to something different than what another processor does, and it has to do with cycle dependency tracking and that kind of stuff. There's an implementation. Let me actually go ahead and open this issue 159. There's an implementation for how to handle the dependency tracking and the cycle breaking and all that kind of stuff in the JSONLD.js implementation. And there's if you click on the link there down at the bottom, it'll take you to the implementation there. It's fairly simple. Let's see, is that simple. Well, there is an algorithm there. I wouldn't say that it's simple, but it does all of the cycle breaking and whatever. So the proposal that's on the table is basically to document a context processing algorithm that is capable of deterministically resolving dependencies and detecting cyclical dependencies and raising errors when a cycle is detected. It's like, sorry, I guess we don't do cycle breaking, we just raise an error. And then the primary candidate for this algorithm is in the JSON-LD.js implementation.
I wonder if we really need to explicitly lay out what the algorithm is or really what the behavior is.
Well, I guess Dave Longley's concern is that if we don't do that, there is a possibility that someone will implement this in a way that doesn't match what the other implementations do.
So that's what test cases are for, right? In RDFA, for instance, the algorithms are not expressed at nearly that level of detail, and when we've relied upon test cases to flesh out a lot of those corner cases.
That's
and
true.
And the result is it's helped keep those algorithms somewhat manageable.
So a diehard standards person would say everything should be in the spec, although we know in reality that's not what ends up happening. I think this is very much in the gray area in the middle. It's not on one extreme or the other. Like, this is not necessarily a corner case. We need to make sure that, you know, these cycles are detected. So maybe what we do is we say that the algorithm must detect cycles and raise errors when that happens. And if that's the only place where there could be non-determinism, then we're okay.
Which one it picks, if there are, you know, I think that there's a number of cases where we have really stood on our heads to make sure that we pick, say, the same term, given a lot of really obscure examples, you know, sample inputs that I think have made the algorithms very difficult to understand. And in my view, that simplifying those things, and perhaps to the point of being less specific about what happens in a really oddly construed example is not such a bad idea, particularly if what we do is when we notice these things, we have some form of a callback to do notification. You know, in the case of, say, a duplicate and inconsistent description of a term, that to me sounds sort of like an error condition that we want to signal, not necessarily be sure that everyone ends up resolving it exactly the same way. And the same could be said about choosing terms that match the same IRI and when compacting.
Nicholas, Marcus, any thoughts on this particular issue?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree, but I don't know. I'm not sure about it.
Okay. Agree with?
It's difficult sometimes to understand what the algorithms are supposed to do without implementing them. But on the other hand, they are very specific. If you really implement them, they do exactly what, I mean, every implementation is doing exactly the same thing. So it's kind of a trade-off, and I'm not sure what's more important.
I think what the risk is that we don't actually get a good analysis by people that aren't implementing it. And speaking as an implementer, having implemented it, I still don't usually completely understand it. I have to go back and practically debug to figure out exactly what's going on and why.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm leaning a bit towards Greg's notion there that a bit more lenience in how to implement an algorithm and ensuring that test cases cover all the things that might crop up. Maybe even some kind of comment within the spec about that various edge cases and the effect of that. The, stating the intent is more important than the exact algorithm.
Yeah, and perhaps in some cases putting, you know, some more detail in the algorithms in an appendix might be more approachable, because that would allow people to be able to read the core algorithms and get a reasonable understanding for them without subjecting them to the all of the corner cases that we're trying to document.
But at this point, I'd probably say plus zero or something, because I'm leaving too much to interpretation is dangerous too, possibly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, effectively what happened with the HTML4, you know, DOM and all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's why the HTML5 specs are...
really,
that's why
detailed.
The HTML5 specs are, yeah, very, very, very detailed, is because that led to, you know, these diverging implementations that were non-interoperable. And I think I do agree with what Dave Longley's saying in IRC, is that, you know, if you implement the algorithm in the spec, it should pass the test suite. I do understand that there's complexity there in the algorithms already, but I mean, that's, you know, that's why we have a specification, is so that people can read the specification, implement the specification, and come up with something that passes the test suite. I don't think at any point we should have a test in the test suite where no language even hints that the test should exist, you know, in the test suite. So if we have, you know, if we have a test and there's no spec text to refer to in the spec that covers why that test exists, I think that's bad. But I don't think that's what you're saying, Greg. I think you're saying let's figure out some way of not complicating the algorithm, but at the same time stating something in the spec that says, hey, you need to watch out for this.
I mean, yeah. It's still legal to write another algorithm as long as it passes test suite, right? I mean,
conforming. The algorithms are an example in the spec. They're kind of they give you the intent, and hopefully they give you an implementation that if you write would operate. But if you come up with a better implementation or a better algorithm to do the accomplish the task, then that's fine. You can do that as well. You just have to make sure that you're conformant with the test suite in the spec. Dave, we're discussing the trade-off between specifying absolutely everything in the algorithm versus having a test suite pick up some of the corner cases. And I think what we're trying to do is find a middle ground where we don't have to spell everything out in bleeding detail in the spec, but kind of point people at an issue and say, hey, you need to do cycle detection and throw an error if you detect a cycle. And if there's a certain way that we pick, you know, terms or traverse the context, we need to say what that general approach is. I don't know if you had more input on this particular issue. Dave, we can't hear you if you're talking.
So while Dave's collecting his thoughts on that, I'm wondering what if it's possible to normally refer to the test suite when there are questions about how specific things should be resolved rather than algorithmic text.
Yeah, I guess it usually comes down to, you know, could we state it in a sentence? I mean, if these are two sentences that we're talking about, I think that's a perfectly fine addition to the spec. If it's, you know, five steps, then that's probably not. But I don't think that's. I hope we're not talking about adding, you know, that many I hope you're not adding that many steps to the algorithm. Let's see. So, I'm looking at the proposal. So the proposal is basically document a context processing algorithm that is capable of deterministically resolving dependencies and detecting cyclical dependencies and raising errors when a cycle is detected. So would you be opposed to just doing that resolution, Greg?
Well, I guess what I'd probably want to see is some proposed text that would actually, because then we could see it in the context of the algorithm and get an understanding about whether it is a simple clarification to an algorithm or if it really more has a deeper impact.
Okay, so I guess then we'll ask Dave Longley. We can't do that because he's not in the group. We'll ask him to send some spec text to the RDF comments.
I think he can do that. He can send something to RDF comments. Certainly. Where are we with regards to being able to make comments, say, in the GitHub issue repository? There was some notion about sending a weekly update or an update back to them with some discussion of activity, or how was that resolved?
So I think the resolution for that is, you know, we can continue to use the GitHub tracker to discuss the issue, right? There's nothing that prevents us from doing that. If somebody proposes spec text, we would ask them to submit it to the RDF Commons group, or specify that they accept, you know, the terms of the RDF. The easiest thing is just send it to RDF Commons. But, you know, aside from that, we can just continue. It's only if we end up taking a copyrighted block of text and putting it into the spec that we have to be careful. Ideas don't necessarily fall into that category. So how about we'll ask Dave Longley to send some spec text into RDF Commons. He'll send it in, and then we'll figure out if we can integrate it into the spec and it work nicely like that. Does that seem like a reasonable approach to this issue?
Yeah.
Okay, so action is Dave Longley to send suggested spec text into text to modify the algorithm to public RDF comments at w3.org.
Just to respond a little bit to Dave's sort of comment stream in IRC, I guess my concern is that there's been some evidence that the complexity of the spec language of the algorithms in particular has prevented people from getting into the specs further. And I guess that's sort of part of my reaction, is wanting to allow people to participate without fear of being completely buried in details.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an action out there that I probably still have to do something with, is to annotate the RDF transformation algorithms so that it's a little clearer exactly what's going on in each step. And that was in response to that type of input from someone in the RDF working group.
So there, I think there. there are two types of responses to that kind of, you know, that kind of thinking, right? So the first is, yes, you absolutely want to make it easy for people to get involved in the spec and the language, and that's kind of the JSON approach, right? People always point to the JSON spec about how simple it is and easy to understand and it's not complicated, that kind of stuff. The other approach is basically stating that, you know, if you want there to be very solid interoperability, you don't have a choice but to make the algorithms incredibly precise. And if you have effectively an API that is more complex than something as simple as JSON, then inevitably the algorithm is going to be complicated and you're going to shut people out because of that simple fact. Like the HTML5 spec is a great example of that, right? Nobody knows what the algorithms, many of these algorithms do at their depths, and for many web developers, their eyes just glaze over when they look at those algorithms. But that doesn't mean that people don't get involved in the actual language itself. So we could see people getting involved with the language, JSON-LD, but staying very clear of the JSON-LD API, right? And the way that people end up using the JSON-LD API is just via examples online.
It's probably fair to note, though, that HTML is at a different point in its life cycle. And if the original HTML1 spec had the kind of detail in it that HTML5 does, it might likely not have gotten nearly as much uptake and implementation.
That's true. I mean, their argument is, well, it got a bunch of uptake and implementation, but at the cost of the implementations not interoperating. And therefore it was a failure because they didn't, you didn't have interoperable implementations. I mean, I think you can go, you could argue back and forth for hours on.
I think the test suite really, really helps here. And I really was doing RDFA, that really helped me because, frankly, there are a bunch of corner cases that are not called out specifically in the RDFA text. That you get from driving through what the thought process was in going through test cases. And I think if anything, we probably fail from our test cases being too big. There's too much stuff that's tested. So when something goes wrong in the middle of it, it becomes very difficult to know exactly what the specific detail is. But that's where I think that having test cases that drive this thing But I do agree that they shouldn't be based upon nothing. You should be able to follow them back to implications, at least from the spec text, from normative text, as to why it's done in a specific way.
All right. Nicholas, you're on the queue. Sorry.
No, I was just thinking I haven't read the spec in that detail for a long time, and now that I'm catching up in my implementation, I'll do it again. But I wonder if there is potential for internal refactoring of the algorithm, meaning that, for instance, in the RDFA algorithm, there are references within the described algorithm to specific sections further down in the document which detail that specific thing, such as expansion of various stuff. There might be something, some higher level to extract, perhaps. I don't know, just thinking out loud about that. If that, so that we would actually have every detail, we will just not have it sort of in line within one chunk of text, but like a main algorithm and then specific sections detailing the various parts in detail.
Yeah, although I would point out that the RDFA algorithm is implementable if you just read I mean, granted, you have to have a lot of understanding about the web and how IRIs work and how to do resolution, but, you know, I did sit down and with the RDFA algorithm and just implemented the blue box portion of the spec, and it worked the first time. So, but that's not to say that, like you said, not everything is in there, but if you understand how that stuff works, then you should be able to implement it. I think we all agree on what we're trying to do. It's just figuring out what the correct balance is, I think, is the difficult thing, right? We don't want to make it overly verbose and complicated, and we don't want to say nothing so that people have to go to the test cases to figure out what's happening. So hopefully I think what we're talking about is adding maybe another step or 2 to 3 more sentences in the spec somewhere that tell people how to detect cycles and how to choose the proper prefixes.
Well, I think my response is not so much for this specific issue. It's just the general sort of bloat that we have in our algorithms, and I'm thinking specifically about term selection and compaction.
I'm sorry, say that again, Greg.
I'm thinking specifically about term selection and compaction as being an example of where the amount of detail that's necessary in order to ensure that everyone does every corner case exactly the same is a type of thing that tends to push potential implementers away.
But I mean, it's necessary though, right? Because it's a fairly complicated way of choosing the proper thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, we might resolve things simpler that provide for less fidelity than we do right now, for instance, in that case, where you simply choose the first term, the shortest lexicographical thing without as much regard to how it specifically maps to data type usage in lists and sets and things like that, as a way that would accomplish the same thing, which is simpler, but might not provide as much of a desirable result when faced with complicated inputs.
I think that's the part I really think is important, because it's when the data is very complex, you want to be able to use the context to make each part distinct create a date and create a date time would be different properties and things like that.
Yeah, but I just think that with each sort of feature we add, the complexity grows geometrically. You know, so we've got a couple of things in front of us, such as language maps. I haven't even looked at what the implications of implementing that are, which is why I said that maybe some things are an expansion-only type thing and not necessarily don't result in compaction. Because like I also said previously, when I have complex data, I typically am using a custom JSON generator. I'm not simply trying to come up with very specific contexts in order to accomplish what I want. That I find unwieldy.
Okay.
But
digressed,
yeah.
Also, but yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I think that's what we're trying to avoid, or trying to move a bit further, we're trying to step away from this added complexity. And I think it's good, because in the last 2 weeks, we've actually said no to a number of features that we could have said yes to. So maybe once we get these issues kind of dealt with, there we may want to re-raise the issue of how complex we want these algorithms, like the term selection algorithm, to be. Although I am slightly concerned about not allowing complex data to be represented very cleanly in JSON-LD, or surprising people by which term is selected.
Being able to represent in JSON-LD and getting there because of the application of a context on a and when doing compaction are really two different things, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, I think we're out of time for today. Or is there anything else that we need to be aware of or know about before the call next week?
If you have in the back of your mind the idea of something like trailing colons or something, it might be a keyword prefix or something to say that this is only a prefix and not a term. If you see that in real cases, just keep an eye out for it.
Okay, all right. I mean, you might want to raise an issue on that.
I'll try to find out the cases
priority.
Where...
Right, you're not looking for a solution right now. You're just tracking it so that we can know that it was discussed at some point.
Yes, that's good.
Okay. Okay. That's it for today. Thanks everyone for the great chat, and we'll meet again next week.
Yeah. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
You too. Bye.